So at 4 o'clock in the morning, on a very misty and cold morning, in early April 1957, the SS Strathnava slipped its cables at Tilbury Docks and slid out into the Thames Estuary on its way to Australia with Anne and I and the children on board. Dennis and Olive O'Connell had seen us off the evening before, and they were the only, apart from my parents, they were the only people who came down to see us off. Our trip from Tilbury to Australia was an absolute joy. It was the best holiday Anne and I had ever had. And it was all largely due to the fact that when I'd made out the application form for emigration, I put our names down and put down our occupation as Scientologists. And I put our Scientology degrees of DSCN after our names, and it had qualifications. I'd put down Doctor of Scientology for both of us. I hadn't thought any more of it. The first morning on the ship, we'd already been given, I thought, marvellous cabins we've got. I said to Anne, here we were, right up on the top, right up on the boat deck, right high up, and very few people up there. Most people were down low. It was a one-class ship, one-class migrant ship, and we had beautiful cabins, and the youngsters had cabins to themselves. It was an absolute marvellous. We were right next door to a medical doctor and his wife, two medical specialists. And I thought, well, we've been put up with the professional classes. And it's still the penny didn't drop. Then we had our morning breakfast down in the canteen. Then at the end of the breakfast, one of the stewards came over. He said, you'll be having lunch, he said, Mr. and Mrs. Stevens. He said, you'll be having lunch at the chief engineer's table. He said, I've got some places reserved for you. He said, I'm sorry we couldn't have got you earlier at the chief engineer's table, he said, but we have arrangements to make. That was absolutely marvellous. I mean, we weren't exactly at the captain's table, but the second best table on the boat is the chief engineer's table. So there we were at the chief engineer's table. It's quite obvious that the penny dropped after a while, and I realised what had happened, that the shipping company had seen Doctors of Scientology and assumed that we were academics. We were a couple of Doctors of Science, and they immediately put us on the top deck with the elite, with the professional classes. That's why we were considered the elite on the ship. From that point onwards, the whole voyage was an absolute whirl of social activity. One evening we'd be invited to the chief, well, every evening was a standing invitation to go down for drinks at the chief engineer's cabin. And then other evenings we'd have an invitation to the staff captain's cabin, which we accepted, and there'd be social functions there with drinks and cocktails. And it was absolutely, the only cabin we never got invited to was the captain's cabin. The fog cleared and the cold mist cleared. It stayed with us all the way through the channel and halfway down the Bay of Biscay, which was good because the seas were calm. The Biscay treated us very kindly. Then the sun came through, broke through as we got off the coast of Spain. And our first port of call was at the Canary Islands, because the Suez Canal was closed in 1957. There was some political upheaval there. And we called at the Canary Islands in brilliant sunshine. Oh, it was absolutely gorgeous, because the Canary Islands are the same latitude as Brisbane. And it was April, which was still their late summer, of course, and in April in that latitude. And we stopped there, and then we set off down the coast of Africa, across the equator. And this mad whirl went on. We joined the chess team. There was a chess championship, and I dusted off my old chess skills, and eventually, believe it or not, managed to, as we crossed the night, we crossed the equator after a great tussle with a Lancashire club player. A great tussle with him, and I didn't think I'd ever beat him. I thought the position would be a draw the whole way. About 10 o'clock at night, he just looked at the position, and I thought I was losing, but he could see something I couldn't, and he conceded defeat. So I won the championship, which was absolutely marvellous. Our next stop was Cape Town, and as soon as we got ashore, both Anne and I felt the tension between the white and the black population. This was even back in 1957. You could feel the underlying tension between the whites and the blacks. And I said to Anne, thank God we emigrated to Australia, not to South Africa. We could have emigrated to South Africa, but thank God we didn't. The place was a hotbed, you know. It was just a hotbed of racial tension. Anyway, we got round to Durban, and some people. Scientology was better well known in Durban, and a guy was come down to meet us. We'd written ahead, and a member of the Durban group came down, and he showed us around. He was only there for a few hours. He showed us around Durban in his car, and it was a beautiful hot summer's day. It was in Durban. Of course, in Durban in April, it would have been there late autumn. Durban's around about the same latitude as Sydney. Of course, it was still autumn in Durban. Then we left Durban, the ship then went south on the big circumpolar route to go across to Perth, and of course we got into some bad weather, and we had the worst weather of the trip when we hit the Southern Ocean, went around in the big half circle, went a long way south and came back up again, and on that southern tip of the trip the weather was really bad, but all the wind was, the roaring forties were behind us all the time, but the beautiful sunshine had gone, and there was this roaring gale blowing over the ship from astern, but eventually the sun broke clear as we came back up to the more northern latitudes, more latitudes near the equator, and we pulled into Perth on a beautiful summer's day, and it seemed to us a beautiful summer's day, and actually it was late autumn in Perth and very dry. We got in a cab and went out to visit Stanley Richards. He couldn't come down to meet us because he was auditing, and we got there and met his wife and young family. He was doing marvellously. He had a PE course going. He was busy as hell. And the place felt like a desert. There was a hot wind blowing. I thought, Jesus, is this Australia? He said, oh, this is late summer. We said, we never get any rain in the summer here. He said, we're waiting for the winter rains to start, which, of course, is quite true. Perth is gets all its rain in the wintertime. It's a desert in the summer in Perth. Ship headed off across the Great Australian Bight. Anne and I nearly got thrown out of bed by a big wave one night on some bad weather across the Australian Bight, and we finally got into Melbourne, and it was a great reception in Melbourne we had. There was a big orgy set up. Whether it was official or not, I don't quite recall. It might have been a hazy, I don't know. But there was a whole crowd there. They gave us a great reception, took us off to a restaurant, and we had a marvellously enormous Chinese meal, and went back to one of the group members' houses and had a great social evening there, and they were plying us with questions. They were a marvellously uptone crowd. We really enjoyed our stay in Melbourne. But we were only there just the day, and the following day the ship took off and arrived in Sydney. We were very fortunate in Sydney. We arrived in Sydney, and Ian Scott came to meet us, and Noella Harden. They knew we were coming. They were a couple of old hands in Sydney, and they were about to toss in the flat that they were living in. Well, Ian Scott was living in. He was going to move to another place. No, Noella. She was about to move somewhere else, and she let us have this beautiful flat. It was absolutely superb. After the drabness of London and the cold climate of London, we moved into this beautiful flat. It was May. It was the first week in May, and it was near winter. It was in Sydney, but to us it was blazing hot summer. And although the best of the plants, wasn't many plants flowering in the garden, it seemed like a tropical paradise to us. This beautiful big house that had been rented there. It overlooked Sydney Harbour in the North Shore, in the suburb of Mosman. And we looked out across the harbour, there's a ferries going across. I said, Anne, we've arrived in paradise. Why did we live all those years in that awful climate in London? This is paradise. Right, we quickly settled in, and we hadn't got all that much funds. Our funds were quite tight, so we had to start looking around doing something. And Ian Scott told me that the person to contact right away, he said, get to know, he said, is Marcus Tooley, if you're interested in training. He said he'd be the person. And Ian Scott was quite right. I got round to Tooley. He was, met him, and he was, had been trained in America, and had done some training in Australia, but he had no rights to train. He could only train up to an intermediate level. And he had a whole stack of students there that he got trained, and he got nothing to do with. So we immediately struck a deal. I said, right, well, you supply the students, I'll supply all the training, and we'll get them certificated. I can examine them as well. He said, marvellous. So we struck a financial deal on the thing, and that was the first training course in Sydney. Marcus Tooley was quite a remarkable character. He was more of a businessman than a Scientologist, than an auditor. He later on, he sued a newspaper, and he got into the public eye, and Eventually he quit the field. He never did get any case gains. You couldn't get near his case, and I don't think he ever did have any proper auditing. And he eventually left the field and went back to his business. Now, I believe in later years he became a millionaire. I don't know quite what aspect of business he was in, but I did hear from a couple of people that he eventually became a millionaire businessman in Sydney. But in that period, in 57 to 1960, he was certainly involved with Scientology. He was a strange cove in many ways. I mean, while I was lecturing, he had a few tapes of Ron's, some of which were useful for the HPA course, which I used, but mainly it was me giving the lectures live. And I got into the habit of giving the course at the weekends on Saturdays and Sundays, because the people couldn't get there during the week. So it was a weekend course. It was going to go on for 6 months, every Saturday and every Sunday. And it was a good turnout. I must have been about 30 students on the course. And I was giving a lecture every morning on the cutting a tape on the tape machine and replaying the lecture in the evening. And I soon discovered that, of course, Marcus was there during the week, but normally on Saturday and Sunday he left the place to me. But I noticed that he got to know that I was replaying the tape at between seven and eight on the tape that I'd cut that morning. I was replaying it in the evening, and he used to come into his office there and turn the light on, and you could I knew the light was on, and I knew he could hear the tape machine. He was a funny cove. I mean, he only had to say, well, do you mind if I come into the hall and listen to the tape? He was quite welcome. I wouldn't have minded, because I was cutting the tape, and then the following day on the Sunday I would erase over that tape. You see, I never kept the tapes. So he was looking in the cupboard for the tapes and realised I wasn't keeping them. And he said, my God, this stuff's going out in the desert air. And it was all new, wildly new stuff to him. He'd never heard of it. And now apparently he was sitting in his office, I found out later, scribbling like mad his technical data on pads of paper as it was coming through the wall, coming through the little circulation window there where the fan was going. He could hear the tape recorder. Well, why didn't he speak to me? If he'd wanted the technical data, why go to such peculiar lengths to get it that way? If he wanted the tech data, I would have quite willingly explained it to him. I mean, I wasn't withholding it. The data was quite free as far as I was concerned. I'd give it to anyone. I wasn't withholding it. I certainly wasn't selling it. Well, the course finally finished, and then I got in touch with London and said, well, I've got my students, I've trained them, they've passed my theory exam, I'm happy with them, they've all seemed to pass, how about some certificates? And that's where the crunch came. No certificates. There was some mix-up on the line there, and Jack Parkhouse was gone, and the new person there, who'd never heard of me, and obviously Ron had been up to his tricks. Everything has changed in Hazy London in the period of a year. And no, there was no way I could get a certificate out of the new administration. They said that all these students will have to go down to Melbourne when they set an organisation up in Melbourne, and Melbourne couldn't do it yet. Melbourne wasn't set up yet. They were going to set up a HASI in Melbourne. And when the HASI was set up in Melbourne, the students would have to go to Melbourne and do some training down there. Well, this just wasn't good enough. I said, what about my rights to train? I've got a whole class full of students here who I've told that I can certificate them and give them an HPA certificate. You'll betray my trust. I've got the letter in my hand from Jack Parkhouse giving me the rights to train, authorised by Ron Hubbard. They said, sorry, no go. New policy, so on and so on. So I wrote to Ron, but got no satisfaction. So it left me in one hell of a position. I just had to apologise to a class of 30 students. So I'm sorry, I can't get a certificate for you. Tooley, he wrote off. He was furious about it too, because his good name was upset. They were his comm lines. They were his students originally. And the whole thing was just a mess. It was just another one of these damn flubs by promises by the central org, and not promises that were not kept. Anyway, by this time Marcus had collected some more students who were ready for some more training, but this time, of course, there was no way in the world we could give them an HPA certificate, but we could train them. So I set off with another course, and again, working on the weekends, and I gave a second training course there to the students, and that was the last one. That was the last work I ever did with Tooley. It was just those two courses. Meanwhile, Anne was, she never did get involved with the Tooley organisation. I think she went in once or twice and did a little bit of you know, talking to people and so forth. But she never got on well with Marcus at all. He was a very difficult person to get along with. She never got on with him at all. And she was mainly setting up her con lines. But it was so difficult for us to get established in it as auditors there, because in London, of course, all our work, we realised, all our new pre-clears when we were field auditing were coming in as recommendations from old pre-clears. We were doing such a good job on the old pre-clears that they were telling their friends and family members, and all our new blood coming into our private practice have been coming from old recommendations, which of course is the way it should be. But of course we couldn't get started in Sydney. And eventually relations between Marcus and I became strained, and clearly I wasn't for any much further use for him, because my main use, as far as he's concerned, was the certificated students, which I could no longer do. So we eventually parted company, Marcus and I, and I just gave those two courses. I then went off and did some kept the students we had trained, and ran some TR courses and retread courses on those, and then a few others got together, managed to get the practice going, and a few other students came along the line. I gave a few weekend courses, but I couldn't certificate none of the students, but I could train them, but I couldn't certificate them. They were quite happy. They were very happy with their training that I could give them and so forth. And eventually the practice did begin to build up. Anne's first, we began to get going. And then, of course, they had this big inquiry started up in 1960 in Melbourne. The August started up down there. Peter Williams had come over from the UK. I knew Peter Williams back in the UK. He was on the HPA course just when we left. I had met him just briefly. And he was Ron's new representative in Australia, and he set up a HASI down there. He was the continental director, and he came up to see me in Sydney. Well, he actually came to see me on his way through to Melbourne. As he passed through Sydney, he came over by air, and he passed through Sydney, and he stopped off to see me, and I told him what was going on in Sydney, and he told me the plans for Melbourne. And all that had been happening while I was still training, of course. And then there was the inquiry got underway in 1960, and of course it just completely bankrupted the organisation in Melbourne, this ridiculous inquiry they got themselves into, a government inquiry. You know, the whole thing was simply the whole purpose of it was simply to bankrupt the Scientology movement, which it succeeded in doing. It cost the organisation and the Scientologists down in Melbourne thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And it got nowhere. The end point, the findings were against Scientology, which was obvious from the beginning. That's what the establishment find against Scientology. That was what they wanted to do at the very beginning, and they did it. They simply bankrupted Scientology in the process. But the Scientology movement has now got a very bad press in 1960 in Sydney. The inquiry had been reported, and the Sydney newspapers were definitely against Scientology. So you couldn't, it was no longer good roads and good weather. You couldn't advertise Scientology in Sydney at that time and start a practice up. You couldn't call it Scientology, because the bad press that was going around, people who knew nothing about the subject, all they knew about it was from what they were getting in their newspapers, and it was an awful cult that was driving people mad, and that's what you had to live with. Well, it was very, very difficult to set up a practice against that sort of thing. But nevertheless, Anne and I struggled on. Then round about that period, Peter Williams gave a BSCN type of course down in Melbourne, and invited me to come down, but I have to pay for it. And I thought about that very carefully. I hadn't had any retraining for a number of years. I thought, well, I might as well go down and catch up with the latest. But the thing wasn't any good. It was a complete flop. Peter Williams, for all his organisational skills, wasn't a particularly good instructor, and there wasn't anything there really. It was a waste of money. I wish I hadn't gone there. Didn't get anything out of it. Oh, except that I took my clarinet down with me and played an awful lot of good jazz with the jazz musicians in Melbourne. The traditional jazz was all the rage in those days, and I'd learnt to play in Melbourne, and also in Sydney I picked up the clarinet again and was playing with playing with the traditional jazz boys, and I'd always loved traditional jazz, and I went down and played an awful lot of traditional jazz while I was on that course in Melbourne. So it wasn't a complete write-off. I had myself a ball in the evening playing trad jazz with the jazz fraternity. Anyway, it was soon back to Sydney, and finances were running very low. Anne was keeping her practice going by the skin of her teeth, and I realised that I would have to go and get a job soon to keep the flat going, pay the rent. So I went and got a job at an engineering place, a bit of work there, kept us going. Then got another course going, managed to get some more students together, and got another course going. That kept me going for a few more months. And then Hazzy set up in Melbourne, in Sydney. A guy called George Allen and his wife had come up from Melbourne. They'd been put in charge of the Hazzy in Sydney. And I said to Anne, well, shall I go back in? There might be a job there. She said, well, there's no money in it these days, you know. And I realised that what she said was absolutely true. I mean, even before we'd left London in 1957, Ron had stopped paying salaries and gone on to the unit basis for his staff members. And if you're not familiar with the unit basis, what it means is that the staff are paid proportionally to the amount of money that's collected in any given week. They take the money and they cut it up into little bits. As somebody once said, they take the money that week and they throw it up to the ceiling, and if any of it sticks, they pay that back to the staff. That was the way one wit once put it. That's the unit system. And it's just about right, too, that the 10% of the org's pay went to the old man that came off the top, and another 50% went to pay the rent, and another 40% went to pay expenses and the bills, and whatever was left was divided up on a unit basis between the staff members. It was an awful system. It was an awful system simply because it encouraged overstaffing. Once a staff member agreed to the system, there's no reason why the top executive shouldn't have filled the place with staff members all earning next to nothing, which is precisely what happened. It was no burden on the management if they had 100 people working there, or if they had 10 working there. It didn't cost them any more. So it led to overstaffing, and that was the flaw in the unit system, as well as leading to enormous financial difficulty for the Hazzy staff members. It was all right for Ron. He was earning 10% off the top from every org in the world, but it was no good for the staff members. Anyway, I eventually said to Anne, well, I can't seem to get started here. The press is so bad, and we haven't got enough work to keep both of us going, so either I get a job out of Scientology or I go and join the org staff. So I thought, I'd better go and join the org staff. I said, well, at least I keep my skills in. I said, I can always earn a bit of money in the evenings in my playing my music, which I did. And so I went back to went into work for Hazzy, and I quickly took over the training department, became a director of training, of course. George Allen wasn't a fool. He quickly realised a gem when he had it in his hands. And that began my long association with Hazzy Sydney. I stayed at Hazzy Sydney and stayed out in the field auditing. And I was in Hazzy Sydney doing the training there. I was director of training all the way through, right the way through 1961 it started, right the way through to mid-1962 when the briefing course started up. And the next thing we knew, George Allen, who was in charge of the place, he was also Reg, doing the Reg work, and his wife, Tricia, was DFPing, and I was DFTing, and we had another guy called Ollie, I forget his other name, Oliver something he was, and he was doing the PE work, and there was a girl called Carola doing this new post of HCO secretary, which of course in my days, back in Hazzy in London, there was no such post. It was a strange post, HCO secretary. I later discovered all about HCO secretary because I became HCO secretary for Sydney Hazzy. Anyway, one day George Allen got a note come over from Ron. He wanted Dennis Stevens on the briefing course pronto. And I was the first of this Hazzy Sydney staff members to go over onto the briefing course. And I thought, well, it's a great honour from the old man. Maybe he's forgiven everything again. Maybe it's possible that we can work together again as a team. So I said, OK, I'll accept that. And it was all, I mean, the whole thing was paid. The fare was paid. The briefing course was paid for. I was even going to be earn half pay while I was on, half my normal pay while I was away over there, which was pretty good. I mean, it was a generous offer. And so off I went. This was in, when would this have been? This would have been about April 1962. April 1962, end of winter. Arrived in London. My parents were overjoyed to see me. And, in the 5 years I've been away, England had changed enormously. But it was a beautiful summer. I remember it was a great summer. England's finances, their economy was booming. Kenny Ball was playing the Green Leaves of Summer, seemed to be blaring out from every radio, and everyone was in a high mood, high good tone. There was great work for everyone. The English Prime Minister was about to say, "You've never had it so good," and England was a swinging, this was the swinging 60s of 1962 in London. And it was hardly the same town as I'd left in 1957, just 5 years earlier. The drabness seemed to have gone. It seemed to be a swinging town now, just because its economy had looked up, that was all. And also it had finally thrown off the shackles of the awful Second World War, which had financially ruined Britain. The briefing course was being held, of course, down at East Grinstead at St Hill Manor, which is a great big palatial baronial mansion. Used to be owned by an Indian or something, and built in lavish style. And the course was being held downstairs in the basement, and there was various lecture rooms and so forth. And it had extensive grounds where you could walk around the grounds. Oh, it was the thing was just palatial, and but we weren't allowed upstairs. Upstairs, God, there was they had the whole hall working upstairs, the whole of what would become worldwide organization of Scientology was there upstairs. And the most palatial part of the whole lot was Ron and Mary Sue's premises, where they were living. He had a butler who used to deliver his Coca-Cola on a silver platter. And life was really, really good for the Hubbards in those days. Money was rolling in, there was no doubt about that. And not that Ron hadn't deserved it. So I quickly looked around for some accommodation in East Grinstead, which is about 30 miles south of London. I needed to get a flat there, and I moved in with Edgar Watson, an old hand who I'd known way back in the early days in Scientology. He'd been, you know, he's a northerner, come from the north of England, but he'd been on one of the first students on the HPA course that I'd been auditing back in 1952. So in the latter stages of 1952, early 53, he was one of Edgar Watson. So he remembered me well. We were old buddies. And so, well, yes, he insisted that I come and stay with him because he was on staff looking after the e-meters. So I moved in with Edgar Watson and started in on the briefing course. The material, it was first-class material. Ron was getting his teeth into the subject of gold packages when I got there. And he'd been breaking his teeth on gold packages for some little while, was still breaking his teeth on gold packages. And as it turned out, he continued to break his teeth on gold packages all the time I was there, and for some time afterwards, when his teeth finally broke and he gave up. What Ron never seemed to grasp was, and his research into gold packages was, that when you research gold packages, you either get it exactly right or you kill the preclear. He never did understand that, and he darn near killed most of the people who went through the bloody briefing course during that period. I've never seen such a massive bad off preclears as I saw on that briefing course. It was awful. So their cases hanging out, that high tone arms and stuck needles. I, of course, was very, very fortunate. I didn't know how fortunate I was at the time. I went into it, and of course I had an indestructible case, which was simply because I hadn't got one. I was clear, I had been for many years. So there was it was almost impossible for the tech to do any harm to me. You know, I was proofed against it, had been for years. And so I came out of it, you know, I got, you know, I didn't get any benefit from the goddamn wild stuff he was running. But after a session of it, I could always yawn it off and run a bit of happiness and get rid of the ill effects. Half the poor backers on the course couldn't do that. They weren't far enough up timescale to do it. I mean, if the worst came to the worst, I could always go and sit on the local church spire and yawn it all off too. I mean, I didn't have to have it wrapped around me. I could always go away from it and sit and look at it over there. I mean, I was the theatre clear. Anyway, Ron had got Mary Sue doing the DFP line on us students, and that was a terrible mistake, because one thing Mary Sue couldn't handle was tech. She was very good at raising babies, and she was a nice enough girl to talk to, and she was nice enough socially. But her tech was poor. Even though Ron had bent over backwards trying to train her, she had no flair for it. She thought she had a flair for it, but she had no real flair for tech, Mary Sue. So we worked through the course there, and eventually, after we all got through, I'd been there about 6 months or so, which was no time to be on the briefing course. I mean, some of these characters have been there for a long while. There's a lot of old hands there, American auditors, the Dick and Jan Halpins were there, Wing and Smokey Angel, all the old hands were there, and a fair sprinkling of people from New Zealand. There was Tony Dunleavy, who was the head of the New Zealand org, and his wife. And there was Denny Godgerly up from Melbourne. Melbourne was represented by Godgerly. And, of course, Peter Williams, he was on the course, had been on the course for some while. He was sitting up at the top table. He was the star auditor, Peter was. And I was working my way up the table, working my way up the hall. You see, it was a sort of a status level in the auditing room, that as you progress through the course, your auditing check sheet, you move further and further up the hall. And you started in at the bottom, and you worked your way up the chairs. And the senior auditor, the one nearest to graduation, was right up the top, and that was Peter Williams. He was due to go at any time. And I got up right next to him. I was ready to go. He'd been there about a year. I'd done it in about 6 months. I don't know, more by luck and judgment. But I got there by September, October. I was almost finished my auditing check sheet. And they handed me Tony Dunleavy as a PC. Well, he was a nice enough guy. And the only problem was that Tony Dunleavy had one hell of a PTP, which was in chronic restimulation. He had his wife with him, and she was a beautiful girl, and she was having a torrid love affair with one of the American auditors. Even though there was a stipulation against sex amongst the students, and even though there was a stipulation that thou shalt not have sex with any other girl or any other woman but your spouse, she was having this affair with one of the American bulls, and of course, poor old Tony, it was driving him up the bloody wall. He knew who it was, and he was being thoroughly cuckolded, and he didn't like it one little bit. His masculinity was at stake, and he was fuming. He was just in a state of suppressed murder, was Tony Dunleavy. And I picked up this case that he was handed to me. Apparently his previous auditor practically died with him. And I thought, we'd better hand him over to Dennis Stevens. So he handed him over to me, and after one session I heard about this PTP. His e-meter was all over the bloody place. He was rock slamming like crazy. And he got one of the worst needle reactions I'd ever seen. And I said to Mary Sue, I said, I spent the whole session on his PTP. And she wrote flunk across it, and come and see me. So I went down and saw her, and she said, you're supposed to be running goals on Tony Dunleavy. I said, this guy's not ready to run anything. I said, he's got a god-awful bloody PTP. If you get off, the only thing you can audit on Tony Dunleavy right now is his PTP. She said, well, you can take it from me, Dennis. She said, that you're going to audit goals on Tony Dunleavy. I said, well, you can take it from me, Mary. So I said, if I leave that PTP, that PC will blow. He'll go straight out through the front bloody door, and we won't see the last of him. We'll see the last of him. She said, well, we'll see. She said, if you don't run goals on that PC, she said, you're going to be back down the bottom of the class for failing to obey the instructions of the DFP. I said, well, we'll see, Mary Sue. So I went back in there and thought it over. Well, which way do I go? Do I have my PCs case at heart, or do I do what the DFP says? So I thought, okay, I'm on the course. We have, none of us are supposed to have any cases on the course, so I shall do what the DFP says and see what happens. Could be she's right. So I said to Tony Dunleavy, we're going to leave this PTP, and he opened an eye and looked at me. Leave it, he said. I said, yeah, we're going to leave it. I said, we're going to leave this PTP, and we're going to start doing some goals. And oh no, we're not. I can see that email, the ceiling goals. He says, what about my fucking wife? He was in no mood. No, we'll get off it, Tony. I said, come on, let's get on with some goals. See if we can do some goals. Oh, after about 10 minutes, he just blew. He just got fumed. He's like a steam boiler. I mean, I was sitting there watching him go. Steam boiler, going to come to the boil. He was getting up. The tension was getting up. The needle was quivering. Eventually, the needle went up to about 4.5 and quivered. It did, and suddenly, bang, he blew. Up in the air went the bloody cans. I fielded those and fielded the e-meter. He stalked out through the door. I thought you were going to break the bloody door off the hinges. As out he went into the bloody grounds. And he blew. I said he blew. He did blow. It was quite inevitable. What else could the poor bugger do? You can't audit over a PTP. It's a code break. You can't do it. That's why it's in the code. You can't audit over a PTP. The dust had settled. I wandered out looking for him. Couldn't find him. He'd gone, as far as I was concerned. He wandered around. He disappeared off into the undergrowth somewhere and hid himself and walked around the back lanes for a couple of hours and realised there was no place he could go, so he wandered back in again. And of course, meanwhile, guess what happened? I'd collected every flunk in the book from Mary Sue, and all my passes I'd worked hard for were all gone. My check sheet looked absolutely virgin white. I virtually had to start the bloody course again. And this happened on the Friday. And I got into the habit of going home at the weekends, and I always used to take my dirty washing with me at the weekends, go up to my parents' place. My mum decided to do my washing to save me the laundry bill of having my washing done in East Grinstead. So I used to go home to collect my clean washing, and every Friday night I used to go home. And it was a routine thing. Edgar knew. I used to go home on Friday night, stay up in Edgware with my parents, who were very, very pleased to see me. And I used to get the last train down on Sunday evening. And I'd be coming to East Grinstead about 11 o'clock at night, half past 11 at night, and go back in and go to bed, you know, get up in the morning and be ready on the course. They simply got used to not seeing me at the weekend. They knew I wasn't there, Edgar and co and the rest of the students in the flat. They knew where I was. I was up in London visiting my parents. So I said to myself, my God, now what do I do? Do I do this whole bloody check sheet again? As soon as I get through the bloody check sheet again, they'll hand me some idiot pre-clear who's got another PTP, and they'll blow again. I could be here in this bloody course forever doing Ron's guinea pig work. I could be a guinea pig for the old man's techniques forever. And I said, no, I've had enough of it. I don't believe this is the way Scientology ought to be run. And so I thought, well, the only other way is to go back to Sydney. So I sat and plotted it with great mental deliberation. It took a tremendous amount of plotting, it did. It needed all of my skills to get out of that place. So that Friday evening, I simply packed up my stuff as I usually packed it up. But what Edgar and co didn't notice was that instead of only taking my soiled clothes with me, I took all my clothes with me. Actually, everything went with me. But as I was keeping all in a cupboard, they wouldn't have noticed it, not immediately. They couldn't see the difference between whether half my stuff was missing or whether all of it was missing. I knew they wouldn't be able to spot the difference. They wouldn't even look. Let's assume that I said goodbye. I had dinner with them on Friday evening, the usual time. Went off to get my bus. Said bye-bye, see you Sunday. Said bye-bye, Dennis. He said, have a good, nice weekend. And off I went down to the bus stop. And on the way at the bus stop, I passed Herbie. He was quite used to seeing me go down to the bus stop. And, of course, East Grinstead is not a very big town. And he was in town. I mean, the place was often full of students and staff members. He passed me by in the street while I was waiting for the bus. "Hi, Dennis." He said, "Off home?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going to see my parents." "Have a nice weekend," he said. "Same to you, Herbie." I got on the Green Line bus and got me up to London at about 9 o'clock in the evening. And, got the bus up to Edgware, to my parents' home. And on a Saturday morning, went down to the airlines and cashed in my return half of my ticket. And they said, there's a plane for you on Monday. The plane, next plane out to Sydney is Monday afternoon. I said, "Right, well, I'll be on it." So I'll be on that plane. So I dashed around and prepared everything, said goodbye to my parents, and did all sorts of other things I had to do. Did a bit of shopping and packed all my stuff up, got my e-meter ready, and thought, "Well, Christ, I hope it holds." It did hold. Nothing happened until Sunday. I thought, "Well, if I can get away from here on Monday before the balloon goes up, because when I don't turn up on Sunday night, inquiries will go underway immediately. They'll be on the phone," because I had the phone number of my parents. "They'll be on the phone immediately." So I just kept my fingers crossed, went to bed on Sunday night, and nothing, no phone call. No phone call during the night, no phone call in the morning. Edgar must have assumed. Yes, I sent a telegram. I sent a telegram saying, "Delayed. Sick, delayed, got the flu, be in a day or two." Sent a telegram off. That was it. There was no phone at the place where Edgar was, Edgar's flat. So I sent a cable off on Saturday, a telegram. And he must have received that. So that kept them out of my hair until for a while, I thought. But it didn't. As I found out later, I left Edgware with my parents. They came off to see me off at Heathrow Airport. I left Edgware about midday. And the neighbours, when my parents got home, the neighbours said that about 1 o'clock a car drew up and a fat gentleman walked out of it with two other chaps. And they went walk all around the premises, knocked at the houses and said, "Do you know where Dennis Stevens here? Have you seen him?" And they said, well, they didn't know where he was. They knew he'd been there that weekend, but they said we couldn't say where he'd been. And they kept banging at the door. Well, the neighbours assured them there was no one there. The place was empty. And finally they went away. And I missed them by an hour. They went back and reported that there was nobody in the house in Edgware. And meanwhile, I was getting on the plane at Heathrow Airport, and I got on the plane and was off on my way back to Sydney. When I got back to Sydney, I after an uneventful trip, I got home, and the first thing I did, sent a cable to the old man saying, "Arrived Sydney safely, best Dennis," you know, usual uptone cable, not knowing what terrible tumult that had been in my absence at St. Hills. Trip home had taken a few hours, 48 hours or so, and with the time gap, time difference, and the time my cable had got through. Apparently what had happened, Ron had just hit the bloody roof. I was the first and only person to ever blow from the St. Hill briefing course. I was the only one. Apparently, I didn't know this, but he'd set up a security system there of indicators, quite unknown to the student body, and Ron was absolutely confident that anyone blowing the course would trigger one of these indicators, and he would be alerted, or the staff would be alerted, and one way or another, they would be alerted. And I would, quite unknowingly, just passed through every one of their indicators. I'd shown no indicator to the staff. There was nothing I'd done out and toward. I'd just gone about my complete business as if everything was absolutely normal and blown. And that, of course, the system couldn't handle that. The system that Ron had set up said that if a person's going to blow, he'll show symptoms of blowiness. and Ron had listed all the symptoms, and the staff were looking for symptoms of blowiness, and I was right on high on their list because my pre-clear had blown, you see, session, and my check sheet was now virgin, and I was virtually having to do the whole course again. So I was a high-risk student to blow, and everyone was watching Dennis Stevens. I didn't know this, but the whole staff were watching me like a hawk, and everything was in place to catch Dennis Stevens. That's why, as soon as they received the cable there, they set off on the... they got the cable late at night. They knew that was it. The Dennis had blown, but it was too late for them to go. They got it late at night. And they first thing in the morning, they set off from... Or about 9 or 10 o'clock, they set off by car from East Grinstead. And they didn't believe a word of this thing about me being sick, of course. But they arrived just an hour too late. I was an hour ahead of the bloodhounds and got back to Sydney. But the awful things that Ron did, they collected every overseas student's passport. They all had to sign a form swearing in blood, almost, that they wouldn't blow the course. And, oh my God, it caused a hell of an uproar. Apparently the old man was like a bloody caged tiger, rampaging up and down. He was about to fire people right, left and centre. His security system had failed there. Well, he should have known better. You couldn't, you can't set up a security system against a person, you know, with such a high case condition, you know. You're just asking for trouble. They just walk through the best of security systems. He was dealing with a high grade clear, the old man was. He should have known better than to try and trap a high grade clear. His clear just walks through the security system, even though I was ignorant of them. I just walked straight through his security traps that he'd set up. I just left no trial. I knew if I left a trial, I'd be caught. So I simply left no trial. It's as simple as that. Anyway, I went back on post at the org. Meanwhile, while I was at St Hill, about 3 or 4 weeks before I'd left St Hill, George Allen had left Sydney and gone on the briefing course because they knew that I'd soon be finishing. That was before the trouble blew up. And they expect, well, we'll have a bit of an overlap. So George Allen had left about 3 weeks beforehand. And so he was gone from the org, so they were awfully pleased to see me back at the org. They thought I'd come back under normal circumstances until they got a telex from London saying that Stevens had blown, and they quickly assured Ron that I was back on post and by the telex, and so I went back to my job there. And it all quieted down after a while. After a week or two, all the comm lines settled down and everything went back to normal. I just went back to my post, and after about a month, the org started to fall apart. And I wrote to the old man and said, "Look, there's various things going peculiar in the org." And George was away. While George was there, he'd been holding the line, but with George out of the way, he needed somebody in charge. They had a gang of youngsters there, and they were just playing up, mucking about, and while the cat was away, the mice were playing, you know. And I wrote to Ron and told him this was happening. The org was going to the bloody dogs while George Allen was away. And he cabled over right away and put me in charge of the org. He'd obviously forgiven me. And once I'd come back on the post and my job in the org, he knew that he understood why I'd blown. And I wrote him a long letter explaining exactly why I'd blown, and the question of a long-term PTP, and why it was completely impossible to run anything. It was a breach of the code to attempt to run goals on this pre-clear. You had such a long-term PTP. And I found out later that the auditor, his wife and the American auditor got hauled up before the old man, and they put on e-meters, and the whole thing came to light. And it ended the affair back. He got his wife back, and she was told that she told in no uncertain manner if she played up with any auditors while she was on the course that she'd be fired from the course. That would be it. She'd be gone. So she towed the line, went back to her husband. So some goodness did come out of it eventually. So for a period of about, George was a long time at St Hill. I don't know why they kept him so long. Maybe they weren't happy with his training. Maybe the poor bugger had trouble with the check sheets. I mean, God, anything can happen at St Hill. You can stay there forever. There used to be a joke about at St Hill. When you got to St Hill, the first thing you heard when you got to St Hill was the St Hill joke. And the St Hill joke was about the student who arrived at St Hill and was told by the chief instructor, who was Red Sharp at the time, told by Red Sharp that the student was going to be at St Hill forever, and he got three choices of rooms he could be in. And so they said, you can come and have a look at each room. So the student goes down and looks at the first room. And in the first room, they're all standing up to their necks in excreta and just standing there. And he thought, well, I don't like that very much. And so he said, no, I don't want that room. And he goes along to the next room. And the next room, they're all standing upside down, balancing on their heads upside down on tin tacks. And the student thinks, so, well, I don't fancy doing that forever. So he said, no, I don't want that room. And so the third room he goes to, he looks in there, they're all standing up to their necks in excreta, drinking cups of tea. And he decides to himself, well, at least there's a cup of tea there, and there's no tin tacks, so I'll decide on that room. So he says, right, I'll choose this room. And Red Shark says, right, well, hop in. So he hops in, and he's just got a nice cup of tea in his hand. He's just sipping the cup of tea, and suddenly a panel slides back, and Herbie Parkhouse, the instructor's face appears, says, right, that's it, back on end of tea break, back on your heads. So there I was. I suddenly stopped being DFT. Martin Bentley took over as DFT, and I moved in and became association secretary until such time as George came back. And I was also the org that somehow, for some reason which I've forgotten, was short of an HCO secretary at that precise moment. And it was in Ron's instructions to take over both roles. The HCO sec was doing such a bad job, she's only a young girl, that she dropped off and became one of the org staff. She joined the admin staff in the org. She stopped being HCO sec, and Ron elected me to be HCO sec as well. So there I was, running this bloody org and running the HCO sec post. So I found out all about how to be an HCO secretary, and found out how to run an organisation too, because I was there for about 8 months in 1962-63, right the way through there, until they finally let George go. I reckon they got to a point they hadn't let him go in the end. He's been drawing his old age pension. He seemed to be there forever. Anyway, he finally came back, took up his old post. I went back to my old post, DFT, and we got another girl in, came in to do the HCO sec post, and life somewhat settled down. The next momentous thing that happened around about that time was the arrival of the ethics policies. That hit all the orgs all over the world by storm. Ron had suddenly decided on this subject of ethics, and I was most put out by it. I read through it very, very carefully. It put my hackles up. It didn't feel right. It didn't smell right. I used to go around and say that I made myself most unpopular. People thought I'd been most disloyal, that no good will come of this. No good will come of this ethics. And to me, it never was anything else but a cop-out. And it wasn't, so I never spotted the flaw in the ethics until many years later. But the flaw of Ron's ethics policies was very simple, was a very simple flaw. The ethics policies were based on the premise, based on a known Scientology fact, that all those who commit overt acts against Scientology don't make case gains. Now that is a technical datum. It's a truism. It's absolutely technically true. There's no doubt about that. There's no shred of doubt about the truth of that. But one cannot deduce from that proposition that all those who don't make case gains are committing overt acts against Scientology. And this was the proposition that Ron was putting forward. This is why it was a cop-out. You see, the logic of it is false. I mean, you can't say just because all crows are birds, you can't deduce from the fact that all crows are birds that therefore all birds are crows, any more than you can deduce from the fact that all those who are overt against Scientology don't make case gains. You can't deduce from that all those who don't make case gains are overturning against Scientology, you see. I mean, it's a deduction that will put you, will flank you, and put you at the bottom of the class of even the most elementary course in logic. Yet to Ron and the whole Scientology world seem to, or at least those who agree with the ethics policies, seem to fall for this little bit of slippy logic. Of course, they wanted to agree with it, you see. Everyone was looking for a reason why tech was failing. They needed a reason why, and here was the perfect reason why. Ethics. Cases aren't getting better because they're overtting against Scientology. So if we can get off our lines, all those who are overtting against Scientology, we'll all start to get better. So the reasoning went, the slippy logic. It's a lie, you see, because it's simply, it's not a valid logical deduction. But why weren't the cases getting better? Well, I mentioned that earlier. Ron had broken his teeth on this subject of girls' packages. He was determined to crack it, and it cracked him. The cases weren't getting better on girls' auditing. Auditing girls and girls' packages was not getting the gains that it should have done. Pre-clears were getting worse. And the datum there, as I've already given, is that when you audit girls' packages, you either audit it exactly right, or you kill the pre-clear. And he wasn't auditing it exactly right, so the pre-clears were worsening. He wasn't getting the gains. And he skidded off sideways and slid into this peculiar thing called ethics and tore the whole Scientology field apart with ethics. It was ill-conceived, it was a mistake, it was a technical flub, but it was necessary. It was needed. Everyone needed it, you see. The whole organisation needed it because they couldn't see why they weren't getting the results. Fascinating. I mean, within 3 months of the release of this, of the ethics policies in Scientology in the mid-1960s, the vast majority of the old-timers in Scientology had simply quit, had simply cut lines to the central organisation. Horner was on record as saying that I think Ron's a decent guy and Scientology is a marvellous subject, but their ethics scare the hell out of me. That's an almost a direct quote of Horner. He quit. Of course, it was set up as a no-win situation. If you opposed the ethics, you were obviously an ethics risk. That meant you were overting against Scientology. You see, it was a no-win situation. You couldn't oppose the ethics without becoming an ethics risk. It was in the ethics policies. It said so, you see. So it was a catch-22. It was a catch-22 situation. You see, right from the earliest days in Scientology, every student has to go through this barrier. And there's always people willing to say in Scientology, Dianetics and what have you, that the fault lies in the pre-clear. That if we can't crack the pre-clear's case, then it's not our fault, it's to do with him. People are always willing to put the responsibility over onto the pre-clear. And that will not hold. You cannot do that with a psychotherapy. Once you come along and say, we've got a subject which cracks the mind, we'll handle it, we'll solve the mind. You can't adopt this philosophy, well, if we can't crack the mind, it's not our fault. It's always our fault if we can't crack it, you see. You've got to take total responsibility for your failures. You've got to look at your failures and understand your failures and understand why you're failing, then go in and do something different. Figure out how to do it right. You've got no excuse, you see. So there's no such thing as a cop-out. You can't have a cop-out. You need to have a cop-out. And the ethics was the cop-out of Scientology. Because Ron never got his research right on the subject of goals. He was killing people. That was the simple truth of the matter. He was killing himself too. In his earlier years, he would never have fallen for anything as stupid as ethics. He was too smart a bloke. He was too far uptown. But he'd driven himself down tone scale so far with his auditing on goals, it was killing him too. And he got himself that eventually he got so badly off case-wise that he got into ethics. You could put it that way if you want to, you know. Things got so bad, he got into ethics. Ethics policies. I didn't grasp all this at the time, but I knew, once I read those ethics policies, I knew that the days were numbered for me and the organisation. That there was no real future for me in such an organisation. This jangled, lights were burning, were flicking in my mind. That there's something wrong here, there's something terribly wrong here, no good will come of this. I said so to Ron, no good will come of this. No good will come of it. Let's get off it before we tear the whole bloody place apart. Within 6 months, orgs were tearing each other. Every staff member was versus staff member. We had ethics chits. We had staff members accusing each other of being overting against Scientology, and the whole field was tearing itself apart, and the whole field has never recovered from ethics. It just destroyed the whole of the whole Scientology field and destroyed every organisation. No good ever came of it, because it was based upon this simple lie. All those who overt against Scientology don't get case gains. Therefore, all those who don't get case gains are overting against Scientology. Flunk! It doesn't follow. Anyway, I staggered on with the org, and against my better judgment, I stayed on. And a guy called Peter Sparshot, one of our better staff auditors, he went off to the briefing course, and he completed it, and the power processing came in by then, and he came back, and he started to give the staff some power processing, and I had some power processing, and they were marvellous techniques, a marvellous little technique the power processes were. And but it didn't do all that much for the org. The org was still being held down by its ethics. It was awful to look at the Sydney org at that time, and I look back at that period of time. There we had those beautiful processes, the power processes, the staff were being run on them, and yet organisationally, the whole staff were doing nothing else all day long but write out ethics chits on each other. I was the only one not writing out any ethics chits. I didn't believe in them. I was too busy. They said to me, why aren't you writing ethics chits? Everyone else is writing them. I said, I'm too busy. I've got work to do. I can't be bothered writing these things. Anyway, I said, I don't believe in your ethics. So I'm too busy. Then Ron issued a policy which said, you will always find out the one who's really overting against Scientology in an organisation by collecting up all the ethics chits and find out the person who's got the most ethics chits against him. Well, if you're in a game where you're all writing ethics chits out on each other, if you think about this for a moment, the one who's going to end up with the most ethics chits is the one who writes the least ethics chits. You see that? If you think about it for a moment. As I pointed out to Ron when I first heard that policy, I simply wrote over him and said that the one who writes out the least ethics chits is the one who will be blamed for the overting against the org. It's obvious if you think about it for a moment. But apparently everyone was too goddamn far downscale to appreciate this obvious point. So anyway, I wasn't writing any ethics chits. So eventually I got hauled over the coals in front of ethics. They said, you've got many more ethics chits against you, Dennis, than anyone else in the org. I said, well, you could go through all your ethics chits and find any written by me. As I said, there aren't any. You aren't writing any ethics chits. I said, I know I'm not writing any ethics chits. And that's the reason why I've got more ethics chits against me than anyone else has. If I was to spend all my time writing ethics chits, I said, the other people would have as many ethics chits against them as I've got against me. They haven't got the ones I didn't write, you see. It didn't help. No. There was an inquiry was held, policy was inflexible, and Dennis was suspended off post. Suspended off staff, pending further investigations. Too many ethics chits. Suspected security risk. Out. So I was tossed out. But by that time I was very, very ready to go. I'd had my power processing. And I'd had to sign on for 3 years to get that power processing. And I went away, very despondent, and left the field of Scientology, went back to play my music, started to pick up tone again. And about 3 months later, they wrote me this long letter saying, please come back on staff, your suspension was a mistake. But the answer was no, not this time. Too much water had flown under the bridge. I simply could not live with their ethics policies. I simply wrote back to the org and said that thank you very much for your letter. If my suspension is a mistake, then my 3-year contract I had with the org was broken by you 6 months ago when you suspended me in error. You just admitted that it was an error to suspend me. And so the contract is null and void. Yours sincerely. And they wrote back and said, no, it's not the way. Your contract is still valid. And I wrote back and said, you can't have it both ways. If it was an error suspending me, then you were at fault when you suspended me. And if you were at fault at suspending me, it's you that's violated the contract 6 months ago when you suspended me in error. So you can't have it both ways. If you suspended me in error, it's you that broke the employment contract. Because a part of the employment contract is that I have to work for the org for 3 years, but you have to provide me with a job. If you stop providing me with a job, you've broken the contract. I was quite prepared, yours sincerely, you know, I was quite prepared to take it to law. I knew that I had an absolutely rock-solid case in common law, that it would never even get to court, you know, I mean, no solicitor would touch it. It was about the middle of 1966, and when that happened. And that was the last time I ever worked for the org. That was that was the end. That was the haggling over the haggling over the power processing went on for after that. But that was up to 1966 when I finally quit the org. And of course swore that I would never work for the org again. And of course sworn she'd never work for the org again when she left London. She told me quite definitely that she'd never work for the org again, and she never did. In fact, she never worked for any other Scientology organisation after she left HASI in London in 1957. And she only her only Scientology work, which she was very, very successful at, was as a field auditor. All through those turbulent years from 57 through to 1966, while I'd been fiddling around with the org and the briefing course and so forth, and training students and all that time, Anne had just been methodically building up her practice in her own inimitable way. And she had a very, very fine practice going by that time, very fine practice going. And of course she always was a very, very fine auditor. And the feeling of despondency I had when I left the org, I quickly got to the core of that and got that as is, and quickly realised that by leaving the org, I'd lost a millstone that had been hanging around my neck. I simply was running out of valence on the thing. That the millstone was around my neck. By leaving the org, I'd removed the millstone. I'd been looking at it the wrong way round. That's why I was feeling despondent. There's nothing to feel despondent about. I was now free. And so that resolved that okay. But then it posed the problem of what I was going to do. And for a while I went around with my music, got back into the musical scene, and went to work with a rubber company in Sydney. And I got a fairly decent job with them, and most of my it was a very busy time for me. I was still this time there was a big boom in the traditional jazz scene in Sydney, and by this time I'd always kept up to date with my clarinet playing. I was always a better clarinetist than I was a saxophonist. And there was always a great demand for clarinetists in the jazz, traditional jazz scene. And so I quickly transferred my musical style from the Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw style of playing a clarinet over to the more traditional jazz style. I did love both styles. I could play in both styles. But I quickly mastered the traditional jazz style and was playing trad jazz in Sydney with the best of them in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And I'd be out, but I was repeating my old work, but almost full-time band work that I'd done as a late adolescent when I was 19, 20 years of age in London. Many, many years earlier, I was out three nights a week there, quite regularly playing a clarinet in a trad band doing the club circuit there, all around Sydney. It was a very, very tiring life. I was much older then. It was much older, you know, and working all day. And I kept it up, kept going right the way through there. Yes, I kept it going until about 1973, 74, when it was began to get a little bit too much for me. I was 46 years of age, and this idea of getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to get to work at 8:30, and working all day and getting away from work at 5 o'clock in the evening, and then dashing off somewhere and to get on the bandstand at 8 o'clock and playing in a club till 12:30 at night, 1 o'clock in the morning, and then not getting home till 2 o'clock in the morning and having 4 hours sleep and getting up again at 6 o'clock. Well, you can do that sort of thing. Then doing this three nights a week, sometimes four nights a week. You could do this sort of thing when you're young as an adolescent, but when you're 45 years of age, it's just too much for a while. The old body just cannot stand it. So I had to quit it, but cut it back in the early 1970s, and went back to just playing in the local on the local scene, and was only doing about two evenings a week. I still continued my day job at the rubber factory, but the problem was that during the years when I'd been in the jazz scene, we'd done a lot of TV appearances with the band, and the top management had seen me appearing on television in the jazz bands, and you know, we've been featured bands on a number of TV shows, and they realised that that I was more of a musician than I was a staff member of the rubber factory. So although there was always a job there for me, there was no promotion there for me in the organisation. They simply, you know, realised that my heart wasn't really in the work there, that I was more of a musician at heart than I was interested in swelling the profits of a rubber factory. So it sort of curtailed my progress into the upper management of the firm. But I didn't mind that. I was never interested in business, and nothing I'd ever come across in business in my later life had ever disabused me of my early ideas as a child about business. I simply wasn't interested in business, never have been. I'm not interested in business now. I never have been. I'm just not a businessman. I'm one of the world's worst businessmen, as a matter of fact. I think it took me many years to realise why I was such a bad businessman is because I understand business too very well. I understand its postulate structure, and I don't like its postulate structure. And because I don't like its postulate structure, I can't play that game. And that's why I'm such a terrible businessman. I can't play that game because I don't like its postulates. I understand its postulate structure. It's not a game that appeals to me. I mean, essentially, business is... the purpose of business is to make a profit for the board of directors, for the boss and the board of directors. And in business, profit is made by exploitation. And these postulates I find rather distasteful. But the goal to profit and the goal to exploit, I find very, very distasteful activities. They're very distasteful to me. They're very, very down tone scale to me. They are, both of them. They're not survival purposes, as far as I'm concerned. They never have been for any part of my life. I find that the whole concept of profit and exploitation highly distasteful to me. I'm a firm believer that there's no such thing as a free lunch. What I mean by that is that there's an extension of Newton's third law of motion, that for every profit there's an equal and opposite loss. So if someone's making a profit, then someone somewhere else is making a loss. So if you're getting a free lunch, somebody else is paying for it. So there's no such in this universe. There's no such thing as a free lunch. As far as I'm concerned, there's no hope for our society, no hope for any society, while it proceeds to operate on the basis of doing what is profitable to do, regardless of whether or not it needs to be done. That is entirely the reverse of the way it should be. An optimum society operates on the basis of doing what needs to be done, whether or not it's profitable to do it. So you see, there's no place for me in the business world. I'm completely inimical to their postulates. Anyway, towards 19, I went on from about, as I say, about 1975, I started to cut it back. In 74, 75, I cut back the band music. I kept on at the rubber factory. And quite interesting that some of my level two, I used to do a fair bit of mental research there in quiet moments at the rubber factory. I started to regain my interest in Scientology research while I was working there. We had a quiet period of work. Work was falling off at the rubber factory. And I had a fair lot of quiet periods, and I used to do a lot of techniques and so forth, and just fiddling around. And actually I discovered my level two, my procedure, the level two of my tech there. I actually discovered it while I was at the rubber factory. Quite interesting. I had no place for it then. It was just a technique that occurred to me one day. I thought, well, this is interesting. I did it, and it darn near took the top of my head off. I thought, Jesus Christ, what the hell's this I've tumbled on? And I just, you know, I flattened the process. And that, gee, that's a fascinating process, but I didn't understand what it was. And trying to understand that process was a part of getting me back interested in doing the Scientology research again. Anyway, but come 1977, 78, my parents died. They died very quickly one after the other, back in the UK. For years I've been trying to get them out of Australia. First father died, and before I could get back to the UK to see what the position was with mother, because she was all by herself, she was taken off the hospital, and she died too. And they died within two or three months, just a couple of months of each other. And this was a tremendous shock, not an emotional shock to me, but you know. Suddenly there was something over there, terminals over there, the family over there, and then suddenly there was no family. My main family contacts had gone. There was just empty space over there. And anyway, I got that sort of squared around, run out. And of course, being the only son, the only child, of course, I did inherit the whole of the estate. I was the only benefactor of the estate. And so come 1977-78, a considerable amount of cash arrived, or a reasonably considerable amount of cash after the British government had got their paws on the deducted as much tax as they could, a reasonable amount of cash arrived in my bank balance. And I thought, well, now, if I don't do this research now, I never will get it done. So after due consultation with Anne, I said, I reckon I can do some research for a year or so. And she said, well, that's fair enough by me. She's still continuing her practice. And so I got in and started to work on the research from about 1975, 76. I left the rubber company and started to do the full-time research there. And putting myself on the e-meter day after day, morning after morning, trying to find processes that would run. And so it was slowly I began to get the feel of what the hell I was up against and what the hell I was doing. And began to put forward the various postulates and ideas and considerations that you will find in my research. It was a very long, slow haul. It went right the way through from 1975... right the way through to 1978, 1979, before that section was completed. It was 3 or 4 years, and I was working every day of the week, no exceptions, 2 or 3 hours a day. I put myself in a room on an e-meter, and like putting a child on a toilet, you know, toilet training the child. I was toilet training me to look at my bank, and till I could do it with absolute second nature. I had absolutely no fear of my mind, no fear of my past, no fear of any part of it. I began to look at it, and then I began to really, for the first time, began to understand the postulate structures there of goals and purposes, and see how they worked out in opposition, and started to put together the material, started to get my levels 1, 2, 3 and 4 and 5, started to put the whole thing together and saw the mistakes Ron had made on his own work on goals, and saw the terrible mistakes he'd made and why he'd almost killed everyone that attempted it, and having almost killed myself too. When I say that you either, when you want to work with goals in opposition, you either do it right or you kill the pre-clear. I do say that advisedly. It's not just my Scientology experiences that that I rely upon for that. I do have my own personal experiences in my own research that I darn near killed myself too in my own research before I got it right. So there's no doubt about that datum. One of the biggest disappointments I had around about that time when I completed my research in 78 and 79 was that the people, and I was showing it around to people, that there was a complete lack of interest in it. And it took me a while to realise just why this was. That it's not obvious, it isn't, but the closer you get to the truth of the matter, the less response you will get. You can always, in other words, you can always sell a lie. You can always peddle a lie, and people will buy it. You know, people will always buy a lie, but the truth is completely unsaleable. You know, you can't give it away. You can't give the truth away. It's completely unsaleable. Once I realised that, I understood why nobody was particularly interested in my techniques. They're too true. You know, exactly right, you see. There's too much of an as-isness there of the mind. And so it took me a while to come to grips with that, but I've come to grips with it many years ago. It doesn't bother me in the slightest now. You know, I can hand out my material to someone and they're not the slightest bit interested in it. And I think, oh, well, that's quite normal. This person, they're looking at it and they're not ready for it. Okay, so be it. And but if the person's interested in it, well, okay, I'll help them as far as I can, as much as I can. But it doesn't bother me anymore these days if a person isn't interested in my techniques. I do understand that the truth is an unsaleable commodity in this universe. That brings me into present time pretty well, Greg. Although I completed that bit of section of research in 1978-79, research didn't stop. I do have a lot of research notes still, but they're not in a typed up form, and I wouldn't say the research is complete. I'm not satisfied with the what I call my upper level tech, above level 5 there. It's pretty wild stuff, and I'm far from satisfied with it myself, so it certainly won't be issued. But it all sits there in a pile of research notes at the moment, and That's the way it sits until I can come to make sense of it. But as the the material up to the top of level 5, I believe, is quite capable of taking a person higher case-wise than any of the levels of Scientology that I know of, I'm quite happy to rest on my laurels. As far as I'm concerned, I completed the job I set out to do. That my research will do the job it's meant to do. It will crack the mind, and it will take it apart. It will take it apart methodically. Exactly as I say it will. So I can do what I set out to do. I don't need any upper level tech. Well, I see I'm getting to the end of this one now, Greg, and now would be a very, very good time for me to start winding this up. So I hope this is useful to you. And I've certainly enjoyed cutting this material, digging up these old memories and bringing them into present time and time breaking them and having a having another look at them. And so all the best for now, and I hope to hear from you soon. Bye-bye.